from Memphis, Tennessee. That's Mr. Blues himself, Hank Crawford Jr. on alto sax, with a title track from his 1969 album, Hank Crawford, Mr. Blues. Hank Crawford was one of my favorites, still is. He died in 2009 at the age of 74. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we continue this week with our focus on the Clinton Foundation and its various enterprises. And today we are going to be going to the heart of something that is particularly troublesome to me about the Clinton Foundation and other philanthropies as well. And that is a sense that they are experimenting with the lives of people in the what is euphemistically called the developing world. We've had discussions about that, or underdeveloped world. These places tend not to be underdeveloped as much as they are super exploited. Well, I'm going to go to this who Charles Cortell .com, and you will see posted there all of the relevant materials documenting the subjects. Charles Cortell, a former Wall Street banker and investor who exposed General Electric's massive fraud in 2007-2008 by proving that it had overvalued its stock by hundreds of billions of dollars, for several months now has been deconstructing the highly irregular workings of the Clinton Foundation and related entities operating, quote, charitable, unquote, programs all over the world. But the foundation and its projects are in flagrant violation of U.S. and international law, Ortel tells us, while their stated purposes are philanthropic, he says. The foundation and its various offshoots appear to be nothing more than an elaborate multi-billion dollar slush fund for the Clintons, who have been able to run a renegade operation without tight oversight. Continuing our close look at the foundation and its various charities, we will focus today on the Clinton HIV/AIDS Initiative, which was launched in 2009 in partnership with leading drug manufacturers, quote, to improve treatment access for people with drug-resistant HIV in developing nations, unquote. Just to provide a little context, here is President Clinton, as a matter of fact, announcing the initiative August the 6th, 2009, at the Clinton Foundation's HIV/AIDS Initiative. He said he had struck a deal with leading drug manufacturers to improve access to affordable drugs for people with HIV/AIDS, especially in developing countries. It's a little long for, you know, it's about 4 minutes, but it's very interesting, and it is it's going to get us started on our discussion today.
I must say this is the largest expression of interest in negotiating lower drug prices we've ever had. And since we've been working on this a long time, I thank you for coming. Let me begin by introducing the people who are behind me. Jeffrey Kindler, the chairman and CEO of Pfizer, the world's largest research-based pharmaceutical company. Robert Curry of Mylan, the world's third largest generic producer of pharmaceuticals. And Nimagata Prasad, the founder of Matrix, a company in India that's been our partner in this work since 2003. They are all here, and after I speak, Mr. Kendler and Mr. Curry will speak, and then we'll open the floor to questions. This announcement involves two issues. First, in collaboration with Matrix and Mylan, we are announcing current and future reductions in the prices of what are called second-line drugs to treat HIV that has become resistant to initial first-line treatment. The second is a collaboration with Pfizer to provide a 60% price reduction on a drug to treat tuberculosis in patients that are actually taking second-line HIV medication. Both these price reductions will ensure that we will get more out of the dollars that are available for effective lifelong care and treatment for people living with HIV/AIDS, and that will enable us, for a constant amount of money, which is very important in the current economic crisis, to reach hundreds of thousands of more people and save hundreds of thousands of more lives. This is a very big deal today, and I am profoundly grateful to these people. Let me provide some context. When we started our foundation's HIV/AIDS work in 2002, outside of Brazil and Thailand, where the governments were providing medicine, there were only about 75,000 people in poor and lower middle income countries anywhere in the world who were getting life-saving HIV medicine. 7 years later, through the efforts of governments, non-governmental organizations, and very important donors, including the Global Fund on AIDS, TB, and Malaria, the PEPFAR program, which was begun under President Bush, and UNITAID, which was funded, is funded primarily, but not exclusively, by the French airline tax, there are about 4 million people getting these life-saving treatments. About half of them are taking medicines that are purchased under agreements negotiated by the Clinton Foundation's HIV/AIDS initiative. But with 33 million people living with HIV worldwide, and more people certain to need the medicine to stay alive, and as they live longer, about 10% of them needing the second-line drugs because the first drugs no longer work, we still got a ways to go. It's important to remember that getting people on treatment is only the beginning of a lifelong commitment. Survival relies on uninterrupted treatment for the rest of their lives. And virtually all the patients who start taking drugs for HIV will eventually need to change medicines as the virus mutates and grows resistant. The second-line drugs are much more expensive, primarily because the demand for them is much, much lower. So it's hard to get the benefit of high-volume production and purchase. So sustained treatment is much more costly. This challenge will only grow as the number of second-line patients is projected to double to more than 400,000 in the next 3 years. Historically, the cost of treating the second-line patients has been as much as 10 times as high as the first line. We've negotiated some reductions in that, and we've cut the gap, but it's still 5 or 6 to 1. So that's why this is important today. The dilemma is especially acute in the economic environment today because we have to reach people who need the treatment.
Well, that's President Clinton announcing the Clinton HIV/AIDS Initiative. And Charles, that might have tugged at your heartstrings a bit, but you know something else about this AIDS initiative.
Yeah, I mean, it was just amazing to hear that speech, knowing what I know and what's in the public domain. So let's deconstruct what the president just said. No part of it is true. So the Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS Initiative, an entity or a grouping, was formed, but maybe not legally. There's some evidence to suggest that perhaps a company was formed in the Bahamas in 2002. But it was not until March 24th, 2004, that the Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS Initiative, Inc. was established as an Arkansas corporation in theory, controlled by the Clinton Foundation. But legally, this construction was all wrong. Under U.S. law, you can't set up a charity on an informal basis that operates internationally. Indeed, the exact opposite is the case, to precisely deal with the concerns that are seen in this case study. You have to form a corporation under American law. You have to control your activities of this entity worldwide tightly. That means you have to have an effective board of trustees. That means you have to, in an independent board of trustees, you have to have tight financial and operating controls. You have to staff it with people who are expert in this field. You have to get a real auditing firm to audit your financial results. You have to fill out forms all over the world, wherever you solicit and operate. All this has to be done lawfully, because a U.S., particularly a federally authorized tax-exempt charity, cannot engage, quote, in any illegal activity of any kind, which would include failing to file out your forms. So let's get into this a little bit. In May of 2004, this entity I just mentioned registered in Massachusetts, and in 2005, I believe it is September, October of 2005, they filed a tax form for this Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS initiative, wherein they were asked the question, how many people work for this entity on March 12th? For some reason, they picked March 12th each year. How many employees did you have? And the answer to the question was zero. So please explain how you function from July 12, 2002, when it is announced by Bill Clinton in many places and in numerous press accounts. Please explain who was doing any work on this project and what the financial consequences of that work were. Because when you look through the 2002 and 3 forms, federal tax forms for the main Clinton Foundation, it states in important places on the form that really the purpose in 2 and 3 was just to be a presidential archive and research center in Little Rock, Arkansas, which still hadn't been built in that time frame. So who was doing this work? And how do you perform program expenses in 2003 when you're not paying wages and salaries and benefits to any employees? How do you tightly control an international operation when that's the case? How do you reconcile...
Yes, I'm hearing you.
Yeah, sorry, I thought there was an interruption. How do you reconcile accounts of various governments who claim they gave hundreds of millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation, but there's no evidence of those flows in the Clinton Foundation filings? So for Bill Clinton to stand up there and say that he admitted in that tape that he began work in 2002, all right, where's the evidence of that work? And it's awfully strange to hear him say that, when months after, I'm not sure exactly when in 2009 he was making those remarks, but months afterwards, on around December 31st, 2009, a form was filled out with the IRS creating a new entity called the Clinton Health Access Initiative, Inc. And on that form, it states, under penalties of perjury, that it's not a successor to any other organization. And guess who's the chairman of that organization, of the new one? It's Bill Clinton. Up until December 2009 or so, Bill Clinton is not named as an officer or trustee of any part of the Clinton Foundation. So how does he take credit for doing this? And does he really believe that none of the generic companies that existed around the world were trying to get the price of drugs down? I mean, how can he alone take credit for a process that an industry in India, a nascent industry in India and South Africa and elsewhere, were all trying very hard to get their generic version of these drugs introduced around the world to save money? In fact, when you look into the history, there's a woman, an academic named Lindsay, L-I-N-S-E-Y, McGooey, M-C-G-O-E-Y, who has written a wonderful book about the Gates Foundation. It's a very thoughtful book, and it recounts in great detail that under the Clinton administration, when Bill was president, he, in fact, and Al Gore vigorously contested efforts, particularly in South Africa, of generic drug companies that wanted to do what he's now taking credit for having done. So, you know, the only way I could describe that speech is that it's the words of a pathological liar.
Well, We have an interesting thing here in that, I mean, he sounds very sincere, and this is a very badly needed approach. Something needed to be done. He talked about the fact that so many people with HIV/AIDS were just wasting away until inevitable death and without treatment. And that this was the best way to, this is the best thing that the foundation can do. Except the foundation is not, had not been to, had no personnel qualified to oversee such a program. It had no personnel at all. People.
Yeah.
With the foundation, and that side of chief executive officers, you know, like Pfizer and Matrix and other major drug manufacturers. So how did they get suckered into this?
Well, you see, this is a very interesting question. When you go, there's quite a moving book written by Elton John, or maybe a ghostwriter for Elton John, called "Love Is the Cure," recounting his, you know, actually quite noble struggle to fight HIV/AIDS, in which he describes the way in which Bill Clinton went about this process as far as Elton John has believed it had happened. So what Elton John claims is that at first Bill Clinton went to the branded pharmaceutical companies, and his pitch was not really a charitable pitch. His pitch was to say, listen, and you can see this for yourselves in the book. I forget exactly what page it's under, but just look in the index and you'll find it. Love is the cure. He says, you know, hey guys, you're basically missing out on a business opportunity by keeping the price of HIV/AIDS drugs so high. These people are going to die. And don't you realize that, you know, if you give them the drug, they have to take it for the rest of their lives. So it's a lifelong customer that you're basically losing out on by keeping the price so high just for 1 year, so you should lower your prices. And it's described that the reaction of the branded companies was, you know, heartless, and they just said, no, we're not going to do this. Well, you know, when Bill got involved, let's say he got involved in July 2002, that's well after a company called Cipla, C-I-P-L-A, was pounding the table and had been pounding the table. It's an Indian generic company, demanding, indeed prodding the South African government to give it a mandatory license to introduce these drugs at cut-rate prices inside South Africa. But, you know, Bill fought that effort, and now he's trying to take credit for doing it. And so after the branded companies turned him down, according to Elton John, then convinced the generic companies, who were delighted. See, at that time, no generic versions of these HIV/AIDS drugs produced by foreign drug manufacturers were authorized by the FDA until January of 2005. So these generics companies, you know, they had heard that President George W. Bush and Congress were going to let $15 billion outside the U.S. buy a whole bunch of drugs. They wanted in on that pipeline. And so Bill was quite useful to Matrix and quite useful discipline, these other people. And what Bill doesn't tell you, because he didn't know in that time frame, is that the great man, Mr. Prasad, and I can't pronounce his last name, had a bit of a trouble a number of years later, spending time in prison. So he got in bed, Mr. Clinton, with a bunch of really bad people. And then the question is, you know, where in the Clinton Foundation forms is there any proof that the foundation exercised tight control over these funds and actually bought drugs? There's no line item for drugs in 2002, 2003, 2004, and nothing in 2005. And indeed, there's the annual return for this new thing I mentioned formed in Arkansas is missing for 2005. There is no such form. And the first time you see any mention of pharmaceuticals is 2006. And you add up the amounts that are in the foundation forms for 6, 7, 8, 9, $215 million is spent. Divide that by the annual cost of AIDS treatment, and you're talking about 1 million people being helped for 1 year. That's it. So what happened to all this other money, and how do you square these claims of Clinton's with what appears to be underlying reality. I don't think you can.
Well, by the time this conference was held, this news conference was held, in which the president is talking about all the good work that will be done because he brought together these corporations and basically, you know, hashed out a deal where they would give the sell their drugs at decidedly lower rates. That was the year that Hillary Clinton was named Secretary of State. Is there any coincidence here?
Well, there could well be. You know, actually, Bill held many such press conferences prior to 2009. Actually, Hillary, through the course of her campaigning, losing out to Barack Obama, and then afterwards, is often taking credit, most recently claiming that the Clinton Foundation has helped 9 million people fighting HIV/AIDS around the world, and that's a statistic that PolitiFact and Anderson Cooper have both backed up, even though it is certainly not the case. It's way off. The fact that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State in this time frame most likely was very beneficial. But, you know, it's a mystery to me, particularly looking at the time frame as she became Secretary of State when she was supposedly first nominated. The record suggests that a memorandum of understanding was entered into between the transition team and I guess it was, and the foundation, concerning how the foundation might operate while Hillary was Secretary of State. There are two versions of that memorandum of understanding. There's the one that John Kerry produced, that's in December of 2008, and there's an earlier one that was just released a number of years ago by and found by Judicial Watch that suggests this agreement was entered into on November 16th, 2008. Well, November 16th, 2008 happens to be just about exactly the time that the annual report for the Clinton Foundation in 2007 was being put together. And you can look at that report by going to the New York State Charity Bureau website. And when you look at it in the correspondence file, you will see that the Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS piece was a disaster for two reasons. The first, you know, magically in that year, the revenues of that entity were the largest piece of the whole foundation, exactly equal to the dollar, the expenses. Kind of hard to do that in that year, 2007. Where currencies were in turmoil and where in theory they were operating all over the world. And their assets on the balance sheet exactly equaled their liabilities. Again, impossible. When you take away that big piece of the whole foundation, what's left was hemorrhaging money. Its revenues were smaller than its expenses. And in addition to which, this HIV/AIDS piece in 2007, on March 31st, 2008, had its license yanked by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts with effect from December 31st, 2007. So a real accounting firm doing its work would start by asking the existential question, is this a charity? Without an operating authority from the state of Massachusetts where your headquarters is lodged, this entity, you're not a charity. And if you're not a charity, that means you're in big trouble. And so to write, they would have certainly known this by November 16th, 2008. So why was the Clinton team telling a whole bunch of bunk to President Obama and his team about the state of the foundation on November 16th, 2008? I mean, what the representations in the memorandum of understanding are all false by the Clinton Foundation. It was not a corporation in good standing, a charity in good standing in every jurisdiction where it operated. It was not. It was an extremist. And yet they made these representations, signed the memorandum of understanding, construct the legal agreement on a basis where it's not really a binding legal agreement. And it doesn't bind Bill Clinton. It doesn't bind Chelsea Clinton. It doesn't bind Hillary personally. It's and none of the Clinton family at that point were trustees or officers of the Clinton Foundation. So from a legal standpoint, it's a ruse. You know, so the question is, the first question is, why did Team Obama put up with this? Then the second question is, afterwards, once Hillary became Secretary of State and once Team Obama took control over the IRS and the Justice Department, why weren't there a whole bunch of tough questions asked about this? And where are all the emails that must have existed asking questions, how do we fix this, posing alternatives, and memorializing the approach taken to attempt to fix it, which certainly didn't fix it?
But these drugs that were arranged for at lower prices, according to the president, who gave, which authority sanctioned the quality of these drugs? And was there a time that any of these manufacturers were cited for producing drugs that were, in effect, worthless?
Yes, indeed, Eutrice, and that's an excellent question, and I'm afraid I have to give a very sad answer. There's the biggest producer is a company called Ranbaxy, R-A-N-B-A-X-Y. And just precisely in this time frame that Bill was, you know, putting this thing together, around August of 2004, an internal investigation at Ranbaxy concluded that they did not know the status of any drugs produced prior to that time. They didn't have the ability to test them. Yet they had been distributing these drugs, and, you know, Bill had been promoting them. Bill visited the factory in November of 2003, the press release, picture of them and everything. And the Clinton Foundation entered into an agreement, according to the Ranbaxy annual report for that period, in October of 2003, wherein it was said that Ranbaxy would help, quote, millions of HIV/AIDS patients. Well, how do you sign an agreement with an Indian company and not know that it can't even test the drugs you're buying? And, you know, who was in charge? Ira Magaziner, you know, he's not a medical doctor. He doesn't have experience testing anything. And besides, he was preoccupied doing all sorts of things at once. You know, where's the staff of qualified people? Well, the drama gets worse. We know all this because Ranbaxy had to pay a $500 million fine in May of 2013 to the FDA and others. Now, some of the drugs that Ranbaxy had to pay fines over were not connected to antiretrovirals, these drugs that Bill Clinton was talking about. But the suspicion is that Ranbaxy ARVs, antiretrovirals, entered the global stream, and that many of these drugs were either adulterated and, you know, didn't do anything, or worse, may have been adulterated and poisoned and killed people. I mean, it's terrible. And, you know, Ranbaxy is only one of the companies. There, if you go on the FDA website, they have an excellent record of all the different manufacturers and when their different formulations of drugs were approved. Sometimes they were approved and then they were disciplined and unapproved. You have to look carefully at all this kind of stuff. But the first pass, fairly detailed pass at it, suggests that there are major gaping holes here. And when you think about it as well, what Bill doesn't mention in there, in that talk, is that he chose, or the foundation chose, to focus upon the rural portions of these desperately poor countries. Well, the urban portions, I've been to many of these countries, the urban portions are impossible, but the rural portions, who knows what's out there? And the issue, many studies will show that the medical cost of, you know, the drugs, the cost of the medicine is maybe, you know, 15 to 20, 25% of the annual cost. In addition to the, it's not, you don't just give somebody a pill and, you know, or a box of pills and once a month or something like that. These drugs have toxic side effects. So once you start hooking somebody up to an HIV treatment program, you better make sure you're monitoring that patient. And oftentimes the people who have HIV have other problems. And, you know, sometimes, so HIV drugs might help deal with the HIV issue. They don't cure you, I might add. They merely extend your life, which is great. But, you know, many of these patients have other issues. So, you know, when you're going to help them, you should make sure that you can monitor them, and that you have the infrastructure required, which, of course, most of these countries, many of them still don't have the required infrastructure.
Well, I'm trying to put the two together, the Bill Clinton part and the Hillary Clinton part. You have a former president who is clearly entrepreneurial. At this point, I don't know if he got his law license back because he was disbarred, suspended for 5 years. I don't know if that takes in that this time that where he's operating as an international wheeler dealer. But certainly, he was undertaking things that one would presume would call for a person in good standing in terms of a license to transact this kind of business. In any event, what is the ripple effect? You have an ex-president. He gives credibility to whoever it is he's dealing with, even if, as you just described, the Indian company had to pay a $500 million fine. So in effect, could a case be made that these companies were benefiting from an association with Bill Clinton because that association allowed them to resuscitate themselves and, you know, get some more credibility that they had lost within the industry, and it enabled them, therefore, to improve their position to continue to do business?
Well,
what kind
of
money?
I'll answer both parts of that question. So the first part of the question is that Bill had to, I don't believe technically he was disbarred. I think what he did is he handed back his law license in Arkansas, and then in January of 2001, and months later did the same thing for his Supreme Court license to practice before the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. He turned those in for, you're right, five-year periods. And so, and by most accounts, his chief work fighting HIV/AIDS in theory began around July 2002. So he certainly began this while he was under having had his license suspended. And that's a great question to ask, because when you are associated with a foundation in the United States of America, many of the states, New York being an important one, ask you when you register, have you ever been involved in an administrative proceeding of any type, basically keying in on situations where you might have lied under oath. So President Clinton should have answered the form yes. Even though he was not technically a trustee, there should have been a disclosure in New York, I would argue, of this defect. Additionally, Ira Magaziner had his own problems. He was accused of lying under oath in connection with the Health Care Reform Committee, and there was a process wherein a judge got particularly upset with him. So, you know, both of these guys, centrally involved in the HIV/AIDS efforts, had their defects. As far as operating internationally, you know, the way this works is that every single country has its own way of doing things. You know, they're somewhat coordinated by the World Health Organization, but each country retains latitude to do things, you know, the way each country may want to do them. So to do this properly, you would have had to comply with all of the foreign laws as well. And, you know, judging the way they seem to have treated U.S. law, I think the possibility that they would have done this properly internationally is remote, to be charitable.
Well, I'm also suggesting that this massive effort had to have involved negotiations and somebody signing off as a legal representative for the Clinton Foundation and as the legal observer of this whole process. This is a big thing. So I'm suggesting maybe Bill Clinton, despite the fact that he was suspended from the practice of law at that time, nonetheless might have functioned as a representative, a legal representative, in order to conclude these contracts.
You're absolutely right, Eutrice. I mean, you know, his signature is on so-called memorandums of understanding around the world, at a time when he's not an officer of the Clinton Foundation. So he just, I mean, he's practicing law in Clinton land, you know, where there is no law. I also want to do answer the second part of your question about the drug companies benefiting. So I would regard what happened here primarily, when you look through the known facts, this wasn't a charity. This was a business development exercise for the generic companies. And they were really shrewd people. The man mentioned, Prasad, had it sort of a small company that the Indian stock market rocketed, and he was able through financial engineering to build Matrix into something he could sell. So he pocketed in the realm of north of $100 million. The owners, the big owners of Ranbaxy, they sold that. Matrix was sold in 2006, August. Ranbaxy was sold in 2008, and the owners there pocketed billions of dollars of profit. So, you know, when the IRS normally looks at a charity, what they ask, and they get suspicious, they'll say, all right, let's measure the amount of money that is spent in the so-called, the core activity of a charity, which is called program service expenses. Let's look at those amounts, and then let's look at any gains, private gains, that may have been created through the operation of the charity. So if you look at the Clinton Foundation in those amounts where there is information through 2009, you're talking about program service expenses. Let's be charitable to them and say it's $400 million. In from 2006 to 2009. It wasn't that high, but let's just say that's the number. The gain that Ranbaxy got was over $2 billion. And the IRS would look at that normally and say, now, this sure looks to me as if the charity was used as sort of a good housekeeping seal of approval, and that Bill Clinton's contacts with Hillary Clinton's contacts in the Obama administration were used to grease the way for these Indian generic companies to tap into the PEPFAR and other government aid streams, and that this was a business development exercise. It was not a charity.
Well, similarly, we have the parallel track as it relates to Hillary Clinton. I go back to the time when she was given credit for just being very shrewd, a very shrewd investor, when she translated $1,000. A $1,000 investment in cattle futures that paid off a $98,000 profit. Of course, no insider trading. So here, too, we have the possibility that we have a small, a tight group of people who are contemplating doing something of a huge undertaking that would have major, major profits associated with it. What is happening stateside, as it were, in the and even in India or elsewhere, where the individuals who are playing a main role in this arrangement of reducing the cost of drugs and knowing that this was going to be a major development for the individual companies, is there any evidence that this, in fact, served also as a windfall for the Clintons themselves?
Well, let me answer it a little bit differently, if I may. So the people around this project included a man called Rajat Gupta, who at one point was, you know, one of the demigods on Earth as the first Indian ever to lead the famed consulting firm McKinsey. He had then gotten involved in numerous ventures, philanthropic ventures, equity ventures, et cetera. And finally, it was revealed that around 2008, Mr. Gupta was a simple fraudster. He was trading on inside information, abusing his positions of authority and trust at Goldman Sachs and elsewhere. And he subsequently spent time in prison. Who was he doing that with? He was doing that with a man called Rajaratnam, the tongue twister of a name. That man is a Sri Lankan fellow who's still in prison for insider trading. And Mr. Rajaratnam had a fund called Galleon that actually specialized in this area. Is it possible that the SEC has not yet found, and that Indian authorities have not yet found, that this group may have traded on inside information in India? Wouldn't shock me. And then you start looking at the team of people Mr. Rajaratnam put around, Mr. Gupta put around the American India Foundation, of which Bill was honorary chairman as well, and you discover multiple cases of fraudsters in that operation. So this is why ordinarily the IRS tells people who are going to do an international charity, you better have tight controls over it. You better really know what's going on. You better have strict reporting. You better vet the people who are doing key work, both your vendors, your trustees, your donors, et cetera. You better make sure that you don't get tainted by the community of fraudsters that's always on a lookout for these type of international schemes that can be gamed and used as money laundering exercises and influence peddling exercises. So as far as Bill and Hillary and Chelsea gaining personally, you know, that's going to be a tough one to find unless you're a prosecutor with subpoena power and the ability to go around the world to every conceivable location where accounts may or may not have been set up. I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know off the public evidence concerning the financial, supposed financial reports of this charity, it's a fraud.
Well, at the same time, again, Hillary is very much now entrenched in the Obama administration by this time. And I hear in the course of Bill Clinton's news conference, UNITAID mentioned and other international charitable organizations mentioned as a source of money that would fund this effort and efforts like it, related to it. Does that ring a bell for you right away?
Well, yeah. So UNITAID, you know, I've become rather cynical as I've aged now. And UNITAID has all the hallmarks to me of a classic fraud. So what is UNITAID? UNITAID is a consortium. It's a special type of organization. It is lodged within the confines of the World Health Organization in Geneva. It is thinly staffed. In theory, what UNITAID is a receptacle for the bits and pieces of airline tickets that are negotiated to come out of prices paid by travelers in the participating countries. The biggest donor country is France. Now, but there are others. Korea is an important one. Spain, UK, others are all participants. The only non-government continuing player is the Bill Gates Foundation. So each year, massive amounts of money are taken out of these various countries and sent to Switzerland. So there, along the way, there's the possibility of fraud. Who knows how much money was really collected? Who knows by each airline company and then by each government? And then who knows how careful people may have been sending the money from the donor country to Switzerland? Once it got to WHO, who knows how carefully that pile, each pile, was guarded and whether people might have hived off pieces of that money. And when you look at all of this and ask yourself, where's the audit for UNITAID, you discover that the audit, there was no real audit. There was the state auditor of India, a man who actually at the time took on a number of corruption cases, but UNITAID had no business in India, and this guy was based in India, and the amount of money paid for this audit was de minimis. So it couldn't have been a careful check. It certainly apparently did not flag the fact that a majority of money that UNITAID sent out in the period September 2006 through December 2009, a majority of all its donations went to the Clinton Foundation unit in Massachusetts, whose license to operate had been involuntarily revoked on March 31st, 2008. So obviously they didn't catch that. And, you just look at this thing, and it just reeks. And the fact that nobody yet has complained at UNITAID also reeks. You know, this isn't a case of, the Clinton Foundation was one little piece of it. This is, this was the central piece of UNITAID. And then when you actually, the one thing that gives me a little bit of hope here in this case is that in the UNITAID filings on their website, you can also get the copies of certain board minutes and resolutions. And when I read them carefully and you put a timeline together, and I'll be writing all this up and issuing reports through my website, but when you look at it carefully, you sense that people at UNITAID had figured out there was a problem. And they tried to correct the problem, but rather than deal with it, they just covered it up. And then you start asking yourself, okay, well, who are the various governments that are involved here? And what are the rules that each of these governments have about financing campaigns for president or the equivalent in each country? Might it be that some of the top people here viewed UNITAID as a way to augment their campaign funds. So might this actually be a very serious problem, that it's not simply slippage involving Clinton? Could it involve slippage, fraud involving the French government, the UK government, the Norwegian government, the Korean government? And might it be that, you know, all these vaunted public, in quotes, servants decided rather than to make an issue of what Clinton seemed to be doing, they just copy him?
Well, we know that the Norwegian government, Australia, Canada, and several other governments have begun to look more closely at the Clinton Foundation and the money that each of these governments had funneled to the foundation, ostensibly to assist with its philanthropic endeavors. But we don't know yet how far along they are with these investigations. But I want to ask about an obvious question here about the penchant of the Clintons to behave this way, to be so reckless, but almost always in developing countries, as they say. Do you think they would have behaved this way, or they would have conducted themselves this way in a European country?
Well, far be it from me to bring up what Bill Clinton may have done in the Oval Office. I think the answer to your question is that they were sloppy everywhere. And it's particularly galling, however, that these people, you know, who see themselves as public servants, would get involved in schemes. We talked about Haiti yesterday. But it seems, you know, the countries where they have done the most damage seem to be countries where the people are the most afflicted. So they've operated in Mozambique. And you know, poor Mozambique is a country, I've never been there. I understand it's a beautiful country, but it's been wrecked by, you know, decades of messes, all kinds of internal conflicts and corruption and all this kind of stuff. And they do have a problem with HIV/AIDS there. But, you know, that's one example. Papua New Guinea is a country I've never even thought to try to visit. It's so difficult to get to from New York. But when you look that country up, that's another one that has all kinds of problems. And it would just seem that, you know, the Clintons, I was talking to somebody, it's almost as if they're merchants around misery. You know, where there's misery, they know that there are donors around the world who will send money to sort of arrest the misery, or at least to lessen the misery. They know there's going to be incoming money. They know, and through experience, that there are no real controls here. And so whether it's Bill and Hillary personally or evil cronies around them or all the above, somebody around this looks at this and says, you know, this is great. You know, we can claim that we're helping, but, you know, no one's going to check. And look at all the money that might, you know, find its way into different pockets. And we, you know, the American people, myself included, I fell for this. You know, when I first heard about this way back years ago, that when Bill and George H.W. Bush were, in theory, helping the afflicted people in the tsunami that happened late in 2004, early in 2005, I thought to myself, wow, that's really something. You know, here's two families that don't really get along, putting aside their partisan political differences and really doing some good work. Well, then you try to look at the financial statements for that tsunami fund. Something like 12 to 14 billion were raised for that, and you can't find 12 to 14 billion in any financial statement. So, I don't understand the makeup of somebody who would try something on this global scale. I don't understand that.
But I also don't understand how it is that the system selectively allows them to get away with it. I mean, the average schmo would be under some intense scrutiny by the IRS, by all these different agencies that would be somehow working with each other to figure out what's going on here. But it seems to be the common theme with the Clintons that they literally are above the law. Nobody is subjecting them to any kind of scrutiny, and they have not paid a price for just flagrantly violating the law.
We talked about this before. It's the Gruber syndrome. You know that you know, people are prepared to see something of this magnitude. Enough people are prepared to look at it, suspend the natural disbelief, and dig into it and accept the reality, and then say, "Wait a minute, you can't do this." We've been willing to put up with it for a long time. You mentioned the cattle futures. You know, I did the easy work. I merely was in the hospital room when each of my two children were born, and my ex-wife actually was an accomplished financial trader and investor. And I can tell you, she wasn't thinking about cattle futures as each of those two children emerged into this great world. So the Hillary story that she made that money while she was giving birth to Chelsea is you can't even file that one in the fiction section. That's the fantasy section. But we fell for it. You know, we said, "Oh, okay." You know, the notion that each of these speeches, you know, the price for each of these speeches that Bill and Hillary and now Chelsea are making around the country and the world, that those prices are set at market rates, that's fantasy too. You know, I defy you to find one other person on this planet who gets paid in the way they've been paid for their speeches. Maybe there's somebody, but I'd be surprised.
But even the Boston Globe today, for example, in its editorial, people are saying, "Well, you know, we have some questions, but nope, they're not going very hard at this issue." It seems to be that the so-called conservative media are doing the job of journalism here, and probably more than likely for partisan reasons. But they at least are asking the questions, and they have been probing, and they want answers. And in Congress, they want answers. And we have the Democratic Party all dug in, saying, "Absolutely not. You're not going to get to her. You're not going to get to Bill. They are sacred territory, and you better leave them alone." How do you account for that? What could possibly be that would be the rational decision for a government that says that no one is above the law to take?
Well, I think, you know, there was a point in time where the sharp political operators, and I don't count myself as a political person, but the political insiders were convinced. I remember being months ago lectured to by people, you know, "You better shut up because Hillary Clinton's going to be the president. And once she is, one of her first orders of business is going to be to go after you." And I said, "You know, that doesn't intimidate me." And, so I think a lot of people had watched the Clintons in action when Bill was president, watched how aggressive Hillary was defending Bill through the whole impeachment mess. And, you know, they just didn't want to take on this project. Now, what I'm seeing, I found the Boston Globe editorial actually to be a good piece. I take your point that they talk about all the supposed good work of the Clinton Foundation without checking any of the work. Maybe they'll get to that. I actually contacted the editor of the paper this morning to make myself available to explain the opposing view, and I'm quite happy to do that. You, of course, Utrice, and some of your colleagues are also digging in here. And, you know, this isn't, for me, a narrow political issue. I actually think charities are a wonderful part of the American experience, and that we set, in the main, a nice example for the rest of the world in the way in which, really, it's the poorer people in America reach into our pockets and try to give money to causes that do actually make a positive difference. I think that's wonderful. And, you know, many parts of the world, charities are discouraged. And here we say, no, you know, it's great that Americans will volunteer and get together and care about other people and actually help, unlike politicians who just give speeches. You know, these are people, I mean, some politicians do good work, but, you know, many seem to be people who just are more concerned about their book contracts and their money off of us once they retire. So I think charities are great. I thank you for giving me a chance to talk about this one. And I think that perhaps the benefit that may come out of all this is that once the full story is heard, the Clinton case will be used as a cautionary tale of how charities should not be operated. And people will ask them, they'll learn from this, and they'll say, here's a former president. A lot of people around the world assume that any charity operated by a president, former president, with his own name on it, and then his wife's and his daughter's name, will actually be run lawfully. So they don't even probably yes to check the records and understand the rules. But a lot of people around the world have been hoodwinked here, a lot, and a lot of money has gone missing. And, we deserve a full accounting of it.
I want to thank you very much, Charles, for being with us again today to further enlighten us about the Clinton Foundation. You can look at Charles Ortel's work at charlesortel.com. Stay tuned. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company, and we talk tomorrow. Bye-bye.